Today marks 50 years since that Monday, February 10th, 1964, when millions of Americans woke up wondering what had happened the night before in the Ed Sullivan Show. Ratings services reported that an unheard of 60% of television sets, some 73 million people, were tuned to the Sunday night telecast of the Beatles' appearance on the CBS variety show, with John, Paul, George, and Ringo performing to an audience of hysterical teens and young women. Today, we look back at the British invasion with Baltimore musician Gus Russo and veteran broadcaster Larry Kane. He traveled to every stop on the Beatles' 1964 and 1965 American tours, including their concerts in Baltimore. First, the news. Interrupt that. I enjoy that. 50 years ago last night, an unprecedented 73 million Americans tuned into the Ed Sullivan Show on CBS to finally get their first glimpse of the Beatles live. The broadcast had garnered an enormous amount of hype thanks to some careful planning by the Beatles management team. I Want to Hold Your Hand was the number one song in the U.S. at the time, but it wasn't until their appearance on the show that the Beatlemania swept across the country, forever changing popular music. Viewership aside, the telecast from February 9th, 1964 has remained a significant milestone in American cultural history, despite the fact that the high ratings were due in part to clever marketing. The Beatles and their music affected the public on a much deeper level than marketing could provide. Their unique approach to rock and roll, their charming irreverence, and their unusual style all conveyed a spirit of fun. And after 77 days of mourning the loss of President John F. Kennedy, the country wanted to have fun again. Today on Midday, we take a look back at the effect that that telecast had on everything and the so-called British invasion it spawned with Larry Kane. Larry Kane is a veteran broadcast journalist. He was the only American reporter to actually travel with the Beatles while they toured the United States in 1964 and 1965. He's the author of Ticket to Ride, which recounts his experience with the band during that time, as well as Lennon Revealed, another book. His most recent Beatles-related book is When They Were Boys, The True Story of the Beatles' Rise to the Top. The book details the early days of the band leading up to their explosive American television debut. Larry Kane, I want to welcome you to Midday on WYPR Baltimore.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to talk to you.
Also joining us today is Gus Russo. Gus is back on the show, the Baltimore-bred musician, author of Boomer Days, an autobiographical look at the American baby boomer experience, including a whole lot of music. Gus, nice to have you back on the show with us.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be here.
And later on in this show, we're going to hear from sisters Diane Jensen Glover and Mary Jensen Shay. They were among the throngs of teenage girls deeply moved by the Beatles. We'll be hearing from them, and we'd like to hear from you all throughout this hour. Please share your memories of the Beatles, especially when they first hit the United States and television here. 410-662-8780 is our local number, toll-free long distance, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. And the Midday email address for comments and memories that way, midday@wypr.org. So Larry Kane, I'll start with you. It's great to have you on the show with us. I really appreciate your time today. And I wonder, February 10th, 1964, the day after, what was going on? One of the things I read was that the Beatles were in, like, marathon press conferences and meeting with the press the day after on Monday. But do you have a specific memory from the Monday after the Sullivan Show?
Well, first of all, let's put some things in perspective here. You know, the problem with history, as you know, because you do so much of it, you know, perspective on this program, is that sometimes you really don't understand what was really going on. You only get imagery. In the Beatles invasion, starting, remember, they were on three Sullivan shows. February 9th, February 16th from Miami Beach, where I saw them again, and February 23rd, which was recorded on the evening of February 9th. So the deal he made with them was 10 grand for three shows total, okay? But he realized that this could be just absolutely game-changing. The problem, though, that with the Beatles at first is that their first sort of arrival here was all about fantasia and fandom. It was all fandom. And, you know, when young people ask me today, young people of today, why did those girls scream? Why did they feel in the concerts that I saw that one of them was singing to them? Why did they pull their hair? Why did their eyes bulge out? Why did they have these guttural screams? And I told them, every one of them thought one of them was singing to them. When I mentioned this at the Beatle Fest in New York over the weekend, the 40th annual Beatle Fest, 50th anniversary Beatle Fest, one woman got up and said, "You mean Paul wasn't singing to me?" Okay, so that's what it was. It really wasn't overtaking America for music. That came later. In fact, when I decided to take the summer tour on, my father pulled me aside and he said, "Larry, I've got to tell you, watch your back, kid. They are a menace to society. They are going to destroy America as we know it."
Do you have a memory about the day after the Sullivan show?
Yeah, the day after, everything was kind of calm. They did a lot of interviews. They prepared to leave for Miami. They were pretty stunned. First of all, they were in a studio with glass and steel, and they really didn't know what the reaction was until they found out a month later about the ratings. Ratings didn't come in overnight.
Mm-hmm.
But they were, you know, the primary viewership of that show was 71 million people. The viewership of the next show was about 80. By the time they got to Miami, they were pretty well, had realized that they were taking America by storm, but they still didn't know. Their issue every day was, when is the bubble going to burst? And, you know, in New York, on the train down in Washington, and everything they really conquered, they were still very, very elusive and reluctant to accept it. The news conferences that Monday after were absurd. The reporters were mostly in their mid-30s, 40s, maybe 50s, and they asked silly questions. Like, do you comb your hair? Do you have your hair? Is that your hair? What kind of women do you like? What kind of hemline do you like? What did you eat for breakfast? Do you think that these songs will ever last? Isn't your song kind of bubblegum? Isn't it only for teenagers? And, you know, it's interesting that one of the songs that was sung on that night was Till There Was You, which was not a Beatles song. It was from the fabulous musical The Music Man. And it was purposely put in there by Brian Epstein and his wonderful spinmeisters to guarantee that adults would say, oh, well, they can sing other things than rock and roll, because most adults didn't buy it. Most adults gave them what I gave them in September, August of that year, when my bosses asked me to go after getting a seat on the plane. I said, look, I got the Cuban refugee crisis in Miami. I've got Muhammad Ali, or named Cassius Clay then, fighting for a championship here. I've got this escalating war in Vietnam, the aftermath of the assassination of a president. Why would I want to travel with a band? Besides, you and I both know they'll be here in September and gone in November. And that, Dan, was one of my most visionary viewpoints.
Because I was going to ask you, Larry, you were in Miami. You were working as a radio news director.
Right.
I just wonder how you got that assignment. That's such a great story.
Well, it's a very interesting story, because a lot of people, I always tell the truth, and I don't try to embellish the past, and it wasn't a very good sign of my perspective. Basically, around April of that year, we learned that the Beatles were coming on a 25-city, 36-day tour of America, including a stop at Baltimore. And I will tell you, remind me to tell you about the hotel that we stayed in and how I thought I was losing my mind that night.
Okay, I'll get back to that.
But just remind me, I think it was called the Holiday Inn. But anyway, so I wrote them a letter on behalf of the station asking them for one single interview in the Gator Bowl in Jacksonville, which was the closest place they were coming to Miami. So I put in the letter a bunch of perfume letters from Beatles fans, and I got back a letter from Brian Epstein. I found out later why he wrote me back. In those days, you can only own 7 radio stations, and we had 7. We were the only ones who played top 40 rock and roll music. The others were all oriented toward an African-American audience, and they had a lot of gospel, R&B, church services. So he thought that I was some big-time broadcaster. That's what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote back, and for the sum of $3,000, which is how you pay your way, access on the plane every day, in the limousines, in the hotels, daily conversations with them. And I went to my bosses and said, no, send a DJ. They're real good at this. Send a DJ.
You're a news guy, right?
I'm a news guy.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, why would a news guy want to travel with a band? And besides, I was, a little taken aback that I would even think about this. And my mother, who died that year, told me, this can be very big for you. My father again warned me, don't even go with them. They're going to destroy America as we know it. And so I did go, and I arrived on September 18th, 1964, in San Francisco, and the rest was just a blur.
Wow. Hey, Gus, I'll go to Gus Russo on this. Gus, you were, I can't imagine how old you were.
14.
14, and you were in middle school in Baltimore somewhere?
I was in high school, first year of high school.
Oh, at Mount St. Joe's?
Mount St. Joe, yeah, Irvington.
Okay. So how vivid is your memory of the Sullivan Show and then what came after that at school the next day and after in the weeks that came after that?
It's pretty vivid because I was a musician. I started playing guitar at 9, and I'd already had little folk music groups, and I had my first rock and roll band already by 14. It was pretty remarkable. In those days, we all did it,
mm-hmm.
a lot of young kids. So I was really interested. I was watching everything that was on the Sullivan Show, the Beach Boys, whoever was on. And I was aware of this group because they had sort of gone viral in the 6 weeks prior to the show, which is a remarkable story, too, how they came out of nowhere. So we were all gathered around, what's the big deal? And so it's a pretty vivid memory because as a musician, I wanted to see what they were all about. And mm-hmm. I was just sizing them up, their music, their instruments, the way they played. So it's pretty vivid.
With all the screaming that was going on, could you actually evaluate the music?
On the Sullivan Show, you could. not live and not in a concert, but on the show, they really handled it well.
Well, I want to go back to that. Larry, you touched on it just for a minute. I just want to examine it a little bit more because 50 years later, I'm still trying to figure out the screaming. Okay? If you don't, just indulge me because I still...
I'll tell you what it's about. First of all, growing up in the 50s in high school and junior high school, I can tell you that we weren't expecting young girls to express themselves emotionally in a sort of sexual, passionate kind of thing. I mean, when I got through at school, after editing the school paper, I went to the Longhorn Drive-In. We had a milkshake. And if you literally touched a girl's arm, it was a major event.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I mean, it was a different time. And the girls were expressing themselves in a way that they were never supposed to do in public. I mean, there was Sinatra, there was Presley, nothing like this. And it was very, very passionate. And there were four of them, remember. John, Paul, George, and Ringo. There was almost Pete Best, but that's another story. If he were there, it would have even been worse in terms of the insanity because he was extremely good-looking, which is one of the reasons he was kicked out of the band. And it's kind of interesting, but that some people wanted to be... I'll read you a letter.
About the screaming,
but
Larry.
The letter tells it all.
Okay.
I'll read you one letter.
Okay.
Okay, I have about 500 letters left over from that time. Dear Mr. Kane, this is Sally in Minneapolis. The Beatles are not coming here. They are so fab. They are so great. They are so sexy. Would you please tell George Harrison that I will meet him in downtown Minneapolis at noon on October 24th, and we will seek our destiny together.
Seek our destiny together.
Yeah, this is a teenager.
I understand that.
And so basically, the first rush of Beatlemania had very little to do with the music. Then you take the music, mm-hmm. which was pretty good. I mean, really good. And you find out something that I'm sure Gus didn't know at the time, that the Beatles were so good as a band that when you could hear them, when you could listen to them, and you got it on Sullivan, okay, when you could understand what they were saying, you realize, and this is a tremendous compliment to any band, that they were so good that it was like you were listening to them on the record. You understand what I'm saying, Gus?
Yeah.
And Gus can tell you a little bit more about that because, you saw the Rolling Stones a few years ago in the Super Bowl. They were awful.
Right.
All right? And the Beatles were a perfect band.
What about the girls and the screaming, though, Gus? And then we'll come back to the music in a minute.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I even remember Elvis on Ed Sullivan in 56. That's how old I am. And they screamed for him pretty well. But the problem with Elvis was that after like a 2 or 3 year thing, he went off to the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And it was over.
Mm-hmm.
So we hadn't heard any screaming like this, at least since Elvis. And then he came back and started to do the really bad movies. And there was no light in the tunnel anymore. And so it was like an 8-year wait for... the screaming thing again to happen, and then the Beatles hit, and it was
like an
earthquake.
The same question I do 50 years later, though, about the screaming. Do you still wonder about that kind of reaction to music and to the sexuality?
I think it wasn't for the 14-year-old girls. I don't think it was about the music as much as it was about these four cute guys who were having a lark. They were all laughing. They looked like the Marx Brothers, practically. They were having so much fun, and that's infectious. They were fans of the Goons in England, Peter Sellers and all that stuff, and they exuded fun, and that's a pretty seductive thing.
Here's an item for you that you probably don't know. You know, everybody talks about George Martin, their first, their arranger, and how he put together their music. George Martin had never put together music before. In fact, his claim to fame was Peter Sellers' producer for his albums, his comedy albums. And I think that's pretty interesting. Never put music out ever.
Wow.
And I think it's kind of interesting that they did have that influence from Peter Sellers. And there was a fellow named Formby, who you probably never heard of, from the 1930s, George Formby, who was a risque, kind of burlesque kind of comedian, who was the number one influence on John Lennon. He read everything he could about him. And if you watch their Liverpudlian humor, you understand it. By the way, there's a great guy named Roy Storm. Roy Storm led a band, and its drummer was a guy named Richie Starkey, Ringo Starr. And Rory was a great guy. He had one problem. He had a stuttering, stammering problem, and it prevented him from being a huge success. And the Beatles eventually eclipsed him, and he died. And he died, and the night he died of an overdose, accidental overdose of liquor and pills, his mother found him, and she thought he killed himself, and she killed herself. And it turned out to be one of the most grotesque and horrible funerals in the history of the city of Liverpool. And Ringo couldn't go, and he loved the guy. When you bring him up to Ringo, he starts crying. And I wanted to share with you very briefly Liverpool humor. Somebody said to Ringo, "How come you didn't go?" And he said, and I want you to understand the perspective of this. He said, "Well, I wasn't there when he was born either." So, I mean, you know, a lot of people would consider that crude, but the town has its own sense of humor. The people are lovely. They're very funny. And all that humor that when they were speaking to people, they told me they couldn't believe people were laughing at them.
Larry Kane is one of our guests in this hour of midday, author of When They Were Boys, The True Story of the Beatles' Rise to the Top. We're remembering back to 50 years of the Beatles' debut on American television on The Ed Sullivan Show. You're welcome to join us, 410-662-8780. What do you remember about that night and the next day at high school or junior high school, wherever you were? What do the Beatles mean to you? And when we get back, we're going to talk to one of those young women who were screaming at the Beatles in 1964. Gus Russo is going to talk about the music of the Beatles. You're welcome to join us at 410-662-8780. Close your eyes and 410-662-8780 is a phone number here for midday if you'd like to share a Beatles memory from 50 years ago. Dan Roderick's here. Larry Kane, our guest for a few more minutes, author of When They Were Boys, The True Stories of the Beatles' Rise to the Top. Larry traveled with the Beatles when they went on tour in 1964 and 65. There's some great photographs in the book as well. But Larry, before we let you go, would you mind sharing your memories about the Baltimore stop the Beatles made here? I think it was September 1964.
Well, I have to tell you, I hope nobody takes this as an insult, but there is something about those girls in Baltimore. they were so intense at that Civic Center concert. And remember, some of them came from Philadelphia as well, and some came from Washington. And Baltimore was really the Washington concert for the fall of 1964. It was insanity. I would say that the police department there did a magnificent job of controlling young girls and boys. And there were a lot of boys there, too. And the one thing I will remember the most is that when Paul sang All My Loving, some of the girls tried to rush the stage area, and unsuccessfully, but they were splattered all over the floor. I mean, they were laying down prostrate. They were prostrate. They were, some of them were literally doing what they might do 4 years later in a protest against the Vietnam War, getting dragged away because they weren't moving. And the police were so great, but they didn't know what to do with them, so they couldn't drag him away, so they just laid there. The other thing that I noticed was that there were several ambulances that took people away. But the Beatles in Baltimore loved it for another reason. At the end of the concert, we stayed over at a hotel. I believe it was a Holiday Inn. I don't have my book, Ticket Ride, handy. But so they invited me up to the rooftop restaurant, and some people from Baltimore will remember this. And they always try to get me drunk, and I'm not very good at that. So we were sitting there and I was having a drink, and we're at this restaurant, and they took over the whole restaurant. And all of a sudden, I saw the harbor, and then I didn't. And then I saw the harbor again, and then I didn't.
I know.
This was a revolving restaurant.
So on the Holiday
I thought that I was drunk before I was even drunk. And so we always laughed about that because they didn't even. It was going around very slowly.
Right.
But that was Baltimore. The other thing about Baltimore was that the outside of the arena was very intense, and there were kids who couldn't get in, and they tried to get in. And Baltimore was really the first place where I saw a lot of young adults, and some parents came. And I have to tell you, it was the first place outside of the Hollywood Bowl where I saw some parents grooving on the Beatles. And the Beatles, I can't remember where we went to after that. We flew out the next day, and it was Pittsburgh. And when we got to Pittsburgh, it was not as much. Let me put it this way. The kids, the girls from Baltimore and the girls from Philadelphia were among the most unruly, chaotic and driven I've ever seen. So if you're from Baltimore and you're now 63 years old, I love watching you guys.
Larry, thank you for being with us today in that story. Larry Kane, veteran broadcaster who traveled with the Beatles in 64 and 65. He's written a book about their rise now called When They Were Boys, The True Story of the Beatles' Rise to the Top, published by Running Press. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
And back here in the studio with me is Gus Russo, who's an author and musician based here in Baltimore. And now joining us, Diane Jensen Glover in Studio A as well, who is a Beatles fan from way back there. Diane, nice to have you on the show with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And your sister's with us, too, by phone. Your sister, Mary Jensen Shea, who's in Georgia, joining us. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks. So help me out now. 50 years ago, 1964, the Beatles are on the Ed Sullivan Show. I'll start with you, Diane. Well, you and Mary, were you home together? Where were you that night? Do you remember?
Yes. I'm one of six children, so six of us were watching, along with our parents, the Ed Sullivan Show. And we were, just glued to the television. And
Where did you live? Where was your house?
Three houses from the old Memorial Stadium.
Oh, Edna Gardens.
Gardens. And I attended St. Bernard's parochial school. And I had an older sister, Barbara. She passed away in June. But she's the first person that I knew talked about the Beatles. And she brought home the album, and we played it over and over.
I Want to Hold Your Hand?
Well, that was one of the songs, and She Loves You.
And She Loves You, okay.
Right. And we just played it relentlessly. So then when they came on television, we just loved it. And then,
how did you react in your parents' living room in front of the TV? Mary, do you remember?
Oh, yes. Well, we were all sitting there, and my parents loved them, so it was very open for us. So we just all were just mesmerized by their appearance, and they were so cute. Remember, we were young girls, and this is our first love. We fell in love with the Beatles. You asked why we were screaming and yelling when we went to the concert. It's because you had so much emotion inside you. The only way they released it was to cry, to scream, and yell. And that's how we expressed it. We fell in love with each one of those Beatles.
Wow. And, everyone had a favorite. That was nice,
well,
too.
Well, okay. Yeah. Who was your favorite?
Well, my
Diane?
Favorite changed over time, but in the beginning, it was Paul. And then later years, George was my favorite.
And Mary, how about you?
Mine's always been the favorite, Ringo. Ringo, I just loved his eyes, his humor. I just thought he was the cutest thing in the world.
You thought he was cute?
And I don't know. Yes. When I was little, I was 9 years old when I saw the Beatles in Baltimore. So my parents gave me drums for Christmas, and I remember playing them. And to this day, I have a set of drums, and I play them.
Really? Do you play with Beatles records?
Oh, I play with Beatle records. I play with anything. I love rock and roll.
Ringo.
I love music. I love the Beatles. And
Mary was a Ringo fan.
And I think the music, I know people talk about how, you know, cute they were and so forth, and everyone was screaming, but I thought the music was so good, too. I think it was different. We felt it was special.
I want to ask you this. So they were on television in February 64.
Right.
And so I guess you were listening to records in December, January. This all happened pretty quickly because
yes.
that the release of that album wasn't, or those records, it wasn't until December, like Christmas Day 63.
Right.
So this all happened pretty quickly.
It happened very quickly. And then all the, I remember it being so many magazines coming out and,
right.
and so forth. But that one album, Meet the Beatles, I still remember, I mean, you know, with just
right.
their heads and all in black. I mean, we just played it
over and over again.
Over and over.
Right. Okay. And I wanted to ask Gus Russo a question. Stay with us there, Mary. So that music, what do you think distinguished that music from what else was going on at that time? It was all fresh and new. Was this really a new sound?
It was really a new sound. And I, as a young musician, and actually I was very cynical about them because I thought it was something for the 14-year-old girls. So I was watching the Ed Sullivan Show thinking they're not going to be anything. I really wasn't expecting. I just thought they were cute, maybe cute for the girls or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it blew everybody away, all my musicians' friends. What they were doing was pretty unique and unparalleled. They had three guys up front, all could sing great. That you didn't see that. You had, they were writing the kind of things, the kind of instruments they had. Nobody had these instruments in America. The Hofner bass that McCartney used had a unique sound to it. There was none in America. There was no left-handed ones practically in the world. He had the only one. The guitar that John had a unique sound. That was a one-off guitar made by Rickenbacker. Nobody had that. The amplifiers that they were using, and we learned this later, were made specifically for them, and they were later produced, the Vox 50-watt amp. But combined, it gave them a sound. Combined with their musicianship, keep in mind they'd already been together 4 years, and they were tight. You know, they were really confident,
mm-hmm.
and they had the appearance of four guys who were saying, "Let's show what we can do because we really know what we're doing."
Right.
And they were confident.
They were
smiling.
They were poised on live television, I would think. My observations of them and things I've read indicate they were quite poised about being on TV, not intimidated at all.
And they were all sick. They all had a cold. George had 104 temperature. He was in bed all weekend.
Right.
And he was swaying. He could hardly stand up on stage on the Sullivan Show.
You wanted to talk a little bit about the music, specifically the guitar work. So why don't we do that now, Gus?
Sure.
First of all, you wanted to talk a little bit about the uniqueness of the rhythm guitar in the Beatles.
What John was doing hasn't been done since, to my knowledge, and had only been done once before, possibly on the piano in the 50s. He was playing these ridiculously fast triplets on the guitar for 3 minutes, playing chords, and to the guitarists out there, try doing this. It's really difficult.
Let's listen to this. Oh, I see what you mean.
He made it look easy, but it's really difficult.
That's a really distinctive Beatles sound there, isn't it?
You know, I think that comes from, he was in a skiffle band as a teenager, and the skiffle rhythms were really fast guitar rhythms, and there hasn't been a rhythm like that since. So as a young person, we're watching this, and we're saying, what is he doing? I've never heard it. Not only was the tone interesting, but the kind of playing was like from Mars.
And now, how about the bass work? You're talking about George here?
Paul.
Paul on the bass.
Okay, so Paul is the lead singer on the very first song out of the box, All My Lovin', where John's doing that fast triplet stuff. Paul is the lead singer, and you very rarely had lead singing bass players in those days.
That's why I just made the mistake.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I always thought George was the bass player.
You never saw it up until then. So right. Here's a guy playing, but he's not just playing the note of the chord, like boom, like you would if you're trying to sing at the same time. He's playing this melody counter to what he's singing, and it's like, how is he doing this?
How did he do that?
He'd been playing forever, and hear the melody.
Yeah, how if when you're responsible for that, how do you sing the song? Right.
Good question. A lot of talent.
And Diane, you went from being a fan of Paul. Did you drift to another Beatle? Huh?
Years later. But when they were a group, it was always Paul for me.
Right. Paul was the cutest one, wasn't he? Yeah.
He had the eyes.
Yeah. And I always wondered how boys reacted to this, because I remember thinking, well, this is really weird. Why are they all screaming? Although I thought the Beatles were totally cool. I wanted to immediately grow my hair long, and I wanted to learn how to play the drums. And I actually did those things. But I did wonder how boys reacted to the Beatles versus the girls.
And I had a younger brother who just loved the Beatles. But also, after the Beatles, it began the British invasion, and then all the other groups, you know, came. And I think it opened up a whole new
Definitely.
World. I mean, group to all over the world. But my brother was a big fan of the Beatles. So he didn't hear screaming.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the music. I mean, the screaming, the reaction that day was,
the boys didn't
why
scream.
Are the girls getting so carried away? I mean, you know, I think you've explained
it.
Well, I
think some girls, too, they scream, and because they're screaming, you're screaming.
Mary, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, as I said before, I think it's because, remember, we're, you know, young girls, and you know, we're starting to think about boys and in love. And we literally had all that emotion when they came, and we fell in love with them, literally. And you know how that feels when you're first love. And, you know, they're our last love as well, because they are our first love. And I think that's what's part of it. They made us feel things we'd never felt before. And we expressed them as we probably never would before, but we just felt so free and open. They opened doors for us.
And
literally.
Also, their early songs, mm-hmm. You know, the words to their songs, like mm-hmm. Until There Was You, and you could sing, you know, you knew all the words to the songs.
You felt they were singing right to you. You really thought they were singing to you, and one and only you, and that's what made you even more enamored with them.
That's the voice on the phone of Mary Jensen Shea, her sister Diane Jensen Glover, in the studio with us. They both grew up in Baltimore. And did you go to the Beatles concert when they came?
Oh, yes.
Yes, we went together.
All right, we're going to talk about that after another break coming up here. I noticed that the ticket price to the Beatles concert in September 64, they had two concerts at the Civic Center. $3.75 was the cost.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, before we leave I don't want to leave the music completely here, because I want to talk about some of the Beatles songs as we go forward. Gus, you had one more thing you wanted to point out about the Beatles' musical style. So talk about this, the guitar solo.
Yeah. Well, you had these two unique things going on. Well, you had three unique things. Ringo was a left-handed guy playing on a right-handed drum kit, so his patterns were all bizarre. You had John playing these triplets. You had Paul doing a walking bass while he's singing. And then George, the soloist, the lead guy, he plays sort of a Chet Atkins country, what they call chicken picking guitar solo. So all those things combined, it was like, who are these aliens playing like this?
Here's the George part, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's country music.
It's rockabilly.
Rockabilly,
practically,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, so you had these crazy things, and then they went right into the next song.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, to really show off what they were trying to show off what they could do, they go from that song, think about this, to a Broadway musical song called Till There Was You, which had these crazy diminished chords and 7 flat 5 weird jazz chords,
mm-hmm.
and it was like the same band did both, and it was... The next day, all the musicians were saying, what were those chords?
Right.
Who are these guys?
It was from Music Man, right?
Yeah.
And yet it was a distinctive sound, even though the way you describe it, it sounds like they're all over their place, right? Musically. They weren't.
The sound, they were so tight as a unit because they played so much, including 8-hour gigs in Germany, 8 hours a night, that they had this cohesive sound no matter what they did.
Gus Russo, a Baltimore musician and writer, is with us. And by phone, Mary Jensen Shea, a Beatles fan, and her sister, Diane Jensen Glover, in the Studio A with us. We're talking about the Beatles from 50 years ago. Feel free to give us a ring. Here's a little more Beatles as we go into our break. 410-662-8780 is the number for midday.
On a hill, but I never heard them ringing. No, I never heard them at all. There was you. There were birds in the sky, but I never saw them.
Welcome back to Midday. I want to talk about the Beatles when they got to Baltimore with Diane Glover and Mary Shea, two sisters, joining us. Before we do that, I want to take a couple calls, okay? So feel free to comment, Diane and Gus, to share your thoughts about whatever our listeners have to say. Melissa, thank you for holding. Melissa's here in Baltimore. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm here.
It's your turn, Melissa. Go right ahead.
Oh, wonderful, yeah. I was in, I believe it was 7th grade or 8th grade, and I had learned I Want to Hold Your Hand. Mm-hmm. And I asked my teacher if we, myself and another friend, could go and sing this song to the other classes in this high school. And we actually, he said yes. We went into the science class. We stood up in front of the class and sang and let everybody in, and I Want to Hold Your Hand, and She Loves You, and they loved it, and we went from class to class. That's what I did with my day in high school.
Was this the day after?
Oh, I don't know when it was.
Oh, it
had to be. I had to have learned the song.
Right.
So probably for a little time. But I am 62, turning 63 this year, and I sing also professionally, so a lot. I do actually the song they just did, and I do couple of the ones, Beatles songs, that the older people, I sing for seniors all around.
Well, thank you very much, Melissa. I mean the day after the Ed Sullivan Show, because I was curious what happened that next day. That must have been the talk of high schools all over across the country, every place.
Yeah, it definitely was.
And
yeah.
Barbers worried that they were going to go out of business, right? They were going to have hair to cut. So let's take one more call. Dave, before we talk about the Baltimore concert. Dave, welcome to Midday. Hi.
Hi, great show. I just have to make a comment relating to the hair. Last night after the Olympics, they had an interview with a guy named McDermott, who won the only gold medal for the U.S. in speed skating in Norway, and he was a barber, and he was in the audience when Ed Sullivan recognized him, and after the show, they took a picture of him, like, clipping the hair, hair of the Beatles, so it's just a humorous moment. He was interviewed last night on the Nightline thing, but I wanted to add that I was a follower of Pete Seeger, who passed away recently, playing banjo and the Weavers and folk music, and so when the Beatles hit, it was sort of like, on the banjo, get a guitar.
That's
anyway,
right.
Anyway, great,
yeah.
Great show.
Thank you, Dave.
Great programs. That Grammy show last night was beautiful with the Beatles. And Paul McCartney mentioned they were a great fan of Rodgers and Hart, Rodgers and Hammerstein. That was the Beatle, Paul McCartney, Lennon. That's sort of why they thought, well, we'll do what the previous big songwriters had done. They were influenced by their music. And sometimes, remember, it was either Say It's Your Birthday or Lady Madonna. It was sort of like, is that the Beatles? Their sound was just different.
Right,
so
this
was also a neat aspect of that group.
Thank you, Dave. Yeah, certainly was an interesting 8 years of music from the Beatles.
They were constantly pushing their own envelope of trying to improve their playing and see what they could do. That was the great thing about them, was that they were changing. It wasn't the same band in 64 as it was in 65.
Mm-hmm.
They were real gearheads. They were always looking for new equipment. Manufacturers were running to them saying, look at this new guitar I invented. Would you like to try George? And George would say, yes, this is great. Let's use it on the next record. They were always trying to push. And most bands didn't do that.
Right.
Once you fell into a thing that worked, you stayed with it, but they didn't.
It's interesting visually how everything changed, too. The hair, the clothing, music. American music at that time went from looking like maybe the Kingston Trio to the Beatles virtually overnight. Mary Shea and Diane Glover, you said you were able to get to the Baltimore concert of the Beatles in September. So first of all, what was it like to try to get a ticket? Did you stand in line? Do you remember?
Actually, I don't remember how I got the ticket.
Hold on, one at a time. Mary, I'll go for Mary first.
Go ahead, Mary.
Well, I'm not sure where we got them from, but I just assumed all these years my mother got them for us because my mother loved the Beatles as well.
Okay.
And I guess assumed she got them, but maybe Diane knows better than me on that. But,
I know I did not wait in line, so I don't know if it was done during the mail. But my girlfriend Mary and also my sister who's on the show, Mary Shea, three of us. Mary, my girlfriend was 13, I was 12, and Mary, my sister, was 9. So my mother dropped us off. We went in.
Wow.
Now, my older sister went to the evening show. She was 14.
There was a 4 o'clock show and an 8 o'clock show.
So she went to the evening show, but we went to the afternoon show. And I knew I was just so happy. I had just started eighth grade, and so not all my friends, you know, could get a ticket. And the next day was unbelievable talking about it.
Did you have a good seat?
We had a pretty good seat. We were on the side. We were one of the, I guess, lower balcony.
Okay.
But I thought we had pretty good seats.
And everyone was screaming.
Oh, everyone was screaming.
Right.
Was screaming. But let me just say, remember this as looking around, because I was nine. Everyone else was little. Not everyone, but I was just nine. And I remember the screaming, the yelling, and the crying. But I remember one instant just looking around at everybody and just was mesmerized by their emotions. It was just amazing. And I'm sure I was screaming and crying too, but I remember taking an instant and just looking around at the audience and just could not believe what I was seeing.
I know. That's why 50 years later, I still ask that question. I still wonder about it.
Think of it from John Lennon's perspective, looking out at the crowd, because the word is he was practically blind. He used to wear glasses whenever he wasn't on stage. He could not see what was going on. He heard this din, and all these lights were in his face, and he was sort of like mesmerized by this. He could not see all you young ladies in the crowd. He just felt it. Right. And it was a joke with the Beatles, because he just couldn't see anything.
$3.75 for a ticket.
Can you believe that?
Amazing. Bonnie's calling us from Edgemere. Bonnie, you're on Midday Next. Hi.
Hi. How are you? This is great. I'm having such a good time. I was 11 years old, and my stepsister was 13 or 12 or 13, and we had double beds up in the attic, and we had an old black and white TV in the corner, and we laid down at the end of our beds with our pillows up to our faces, and when they came on the Ed Sullivan Show and he said, "These are the Beatles," and we just screamed into our pillows the whole time. It was so exciting, because we had always listened to Motown, and Motown was a big thing in our area, in Ambler, Pennsylvania. And so we were just all into that whole kind of rhythm beat, and when the Beatles came, it was just like such a fresh new sound, and with the shaking of the heads, and like you said before, the energy and the fun. It was really something else, and my sister collected Beatle cards. We called her the Beatle Maniac, and she collected Beatle cards, which was really, like, popular then, but she had the best collection, which made her very prestigious in the school. So we had a lot of fun.
Yeah,
my two other sisters and I, we'd all four of us go down and play Beatles songs and shake our heads for our parents and put on a little show, and we'd pretend that they were coming over to the house, and we'd make our beds and clean our rooms. We just had a ball.
That's great.
We were really into it, yeah.
That's funny, Bonnie. Thank you very much. You know, Gus, last time you were on the show was the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination.
All these 50-year anniversaries.
Gus's last book was Where Were You?
Right.
And, you know, it's interesting to think of these two events. They weren't that far apart, really, but I guess it was time for the country to have a laugh and to enjoy itself again.
We have some
fun.
You know what? I love the little things in history that trigger the big things. And of course, it was Walter Cronkite, speaking of the Kennedy thing, who announced to the world that Kennedy had died. It was also Walter Cronkite in December of 63, who had a little side bit on his show about the Beatles in England that started it here, because he told his producer, "I've got to put something on that's uplifting. It's been a month and a half since Kennedy died, and what can we do?" And they said, "Well, one of his producers said, there's this little group that's going crazy in England." So he introduced us to the Beatles, and that's what got the hysteria going to release their record in America. They had no record until Cronkite.
Mm-hmm.
The same guy who announced the Kennedy assassination.
His show, the CBS Evening News, aired a brief report about the Beatles.
Very brief, yeah. and a Maryland girl saw it and called up her DJ and said, "You got to play these guys." He had never heard of them either.
Called the DC radio station.
That's right. And that's what started. Cronkite was Kennedy and the Beatles.
Right. Another call, Mel in Baltimore, helping us out, because I asked that question, what happened the day after when America woke up from that the appearance of the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, and that was 50 years ago today. Yeah. Hi, Mel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. I'll add this just little tidbit. I got up the next morning, Monday morning, to go to school. I was 15, and I got on the number 5 bus on Arkites Avenue. I was from Pimlico, and we got on the bus, and me and a friend or two sat down, and everyone was talking. This was so odd to me that we looked around. We were talking about the show the night before, and then I stopped talking and looked up and down the aisles. Every seat was filled, like every morning. The aisle was filled, like every morning, and everybody was talking about the Beatles. I mean, literally, there was the bus driver was leaning back talking to the elderly woman behind him. Every single person, without an exception, was talking about the Beatles. I said to my friend, Hank, look at this. There's nobody not talking about the Beatles. And he said, you're right. This is incredible. Everybody on the bus, there's probably 80 or 100 people. I don't know. There was no exception. Everybody was discussing the show the night before.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
Mary, what did you want to say?
I'm just saying he's right, because you went to school the next day and everybody was talking about it, who they were in love with, who they liked the most. You know, it was just so different than anything we've ever experienced. Everybody was so excited. I don't think we probably slept that well the night after the Ed Sullivan show, and I know we didn't sleep after we went to the concert. We were just too excited.
We were just talking about the Kennedy assassination. I'm sure everybody was talking about that when that happened, too. But think of the contrast, the communal experience over a national tragedy versus something that's completely fun and, it's all about pop culture.
Yeah, we were ready
music.
For it. Yeah, we were ready for a release.
Hey, you know what? It is fun to describe to younger people today who don't know Ed Sullivan, to describe him and what his show was like and how unique that show was. And it doesn't exist anymore, that kind of a show where you would have jugglers and comedians with rock bands. the Rolling Stones would be next to somebody who had trained seals. Yeah. It was amazing. And he was a total stiff, right? He was very cold looking and an awkward man who had a great eye for talent, I guess. Right?
They had lots of variety shows back then, but now... Yeah.
You don't have that kind of show anymore.
That's right.
I don't know what you compare it to.
Nothing today.
Hey, here's a funny story. Mary will enjoy this before we say goodbye to her, and Diane and Gus. This is from Gene, one of our listeners. Beatles on the elevator in Baltimore. Mm. The Beatles got onto the elevator that my mother-in-law was on at the Holiday Inn in Baltimore when the Beatles were playing at the Civic Center. They liked the way she looked and invited her to their party. She said, no, thank you.
I bet she's sorry
she didn't go to that Beatles party at the Holiday Inn. That was a funny story Larry told about being on the revolving. It used to revolve the restaurant at the top of the Holiday Inn. Yeah. And later on this year, I think we'll do a little bit more on the Beatles and the 50th anniversary of their concert in Baltimore, because there's some funny stories that go with that event. How much time do we have left? Can we listen to one? I think it'll be fun to go out and listening to a Beatles song on this day. And I want to thank Diane Jensen Glover, for being with us today. Nice to have you with us, Diane.
Thank you very much.
And Mary Jensen, thank you for joining us, too.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I'm glad I could share some of the stories.
Excellent. All right. And Gus Russo, the author of Boomer Days and then Where Were You? Thank you very much for bringing your musical perspective to this discussion.
My pleasure. Had a lot of fun.
Nice, Gus. Listen to a little more Beatles as we say goodbye to you this afternoon.
Oh, yeah. I tell you something. I think you'll understand when I say that something.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, Maya Brown, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.